The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And the topic tonight is happiness. This is not unconnected to concentration because it's said that the proximate cause for concentration is happiness. Not what I originally thought when I started meditation practice. I thought that concentration was about huffing and puffing and efforting. And so it came as a kind of a surprise to me to hear that actually happiness is one of the things that leads the mind to settle into concentration. And so I'd like to talk about different kinds of happiness tonight. Kind of revisit this idea of happiness. I'll start with a quote from the Dhammapada. This is the Dhammapada is a, that's a collection of poems, basically, said to have been composed by the Buddha. If by giving up a lesser happiness, one could experience greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. I think that most of us would agree with that. That if we knew for sure there was a greater kind of happiness that could be had by letting go of a lesser kind of happiness, we might be interested in exploring that. I think the wish for happiness is fairly universal. We all do want to be happy some way or another, whether that means to be without struggle or to be more ecstatic in some way. As a human wish, I think it is part and parcel of being human to wish for happiness. And our conditioning, the way that we've learned or the way that we've experienced happiness, let's say that, the way that we've experienced happiness mostly in our lives has to do with having things or having people's opinions about us be what we want them to be. So, you know, there is a happiness that comes from acquiring things and having things and not having things in our life that we don't want to have in our lives. And there's also a happiness that comes from being seen or being recognized or being appreciated, having people admire us or like us. And this is, I think, our usual understanding of happiness, and perhaps our idea of, you know, what would we think happiness is? What would we think a happy life is? I think most of us would recognize or realize that the happiness of having things and the happiness of having particular status or being praised, that those happinesses come and go. And yet, what we think is that the best kind of happiness would be if we could string together, like just as one of those happinesses is just passing, if another one would be coming up. So it'd be like, you know, stringing beads on a string, that just as one is just beginning to fall off one end, another one is coming in. And that would be our idea, I think, of the best kind of happiness that there might be, that might be possible. And so I'd like to question that. I'd like to look at that kind of happiness a little bit and reflect on it. Because the Buddha actually points out to us that that kind of happiness, the kind of happiness that comes from getting what we want, from having people praise us, from essentially acquiring things, whether it's opinions or material goods, that that kind of happiness that working towards that kind of happiness essentially keeps us stuck in a loop. It keeps us stuck, essentially, like just as that one kind of happiness is falling apart, there's this feeling of loss, of lack, of something's wrong, I need to fix it, I need to find that next happiness. And so we're caught in this trap of, with this way of our usual way of thinking about happiness, we're caught in this trap of needing to figure out how to get our next happiness, our next hit of having. And that that keeps us caught on a cycle of wanting, having, and then that having kind of falls apart, and then what happens is that having falls apart is that we want something else, because the last time we felt good was when we had what we wanted. This is kind of the essential pattern. The best that we can imagine happiness is having what we want. And so that's where we look for it. And that's where we go. And that's where we get kind of stuck, because we think that the only way to be happy is to have what we want. And the Buddha asked us to look at this, actually. He said, you know, well, let's look at this. Let's look at what happens when we have what we want, when we get what we want. We get a little bit of happiness that comes from the having. Often we want pleasant things, or we want to get rid of something unpleasant. And either having the pleasant, when we have that pleasant thing, there's a little bit of pleasantness that comes with that. When we get rid of something unpleasant that we don't want, there's a little bit of pleasantness that comes with that. And so the very having the thing that we want, or getting rid of the thing that we don't want, has some pleasantness to it. There is a little bit of pleasantness to that. It's fairly, those kinds of pleasantnesses don't last that long, because our memories aren't that, like our minds aren't that, they don't hold on to that for very long. Like we get something we want. I mean, just think about the last time you got something you really wanted. You really, really wanted. And how happy are you about that thing now? I mean, maybe there's still some lingering happiness about that thing, but it fades. The happy feeling, the pleasant feeling of having that thing fades. Another part of the pleasantness, or another part of the reason why we like so much getting what we want. And this is harder for us to see, but if you actually start to look in your experience, you'll start to see this piece too. But another part of the reason we become happy when we get what we want is because the feeling of wanting, you know, the feeling of wanting doesn't feel very good. It's kind of got this it feels like lack. When we want something, it feels like there's something missing. And so there's inherently a sense that something's off or something's wrong or something's lacking when we want something. And so that's an unpleasant experience, that wanting. And when we get what we want, for a moment at least, that feeling of wanting goes away. And I will propose to you that actually that's the larger part of the happiness of having what we want. That might be kind of surprising, but explore it a little bit. See what happens if you check into it. One way to explore this would be to take something find a time when there's something you want, something small, you know, something pretty trivial, but something that you want. And instead of getting the thing and having the happiness of having it, see if you can watch the wanting Watch the feeling of lack of not having that thing. And see what happens as you watch that feeling. It doesn't feel very good. You'll see really clearly that the feeling of wanting is unpleasant. But fortunately, impermanence works in our favor here because wanting also will go away. And so you can watch what happens in the case where wanting goes away without actually getting what it wanted. In my experience, it's like being released from a vice grip. And the mind in that moment recognizes that the release of wanting is a way better happiness than the happiness of having. In that exploration, you'll begin to see that distinction. If we start to explore this pattern around wanting, you know, it's not that sense pleasure is going to go away. You know, our lives are going to have pleasure and pain and neutral in just flowing through it. And you know, paradoxically, if we find a way, if we explore a little bit about changing our relationship to material things, changing our relationship to sense pleasure, essentially, and rather than grasping after it, trying to find sense pleasure, trying to hold on to sense pleasure, trying to construct this thread of moment after moment of pleasant experience. As our relationship to that changes, you know, paradoxically we find that small pleasures, simple things, like hearing the sound of a train, can be quite delightful. That when we're not looking and grasping, that the simplicity of a moment of hearing a bird or seeing a blue sky or watching the moon rise can be so beautiful. And so sense pleasure has a deeper kind of happiness to it when we're not grasping after it. It's a very ephemeral kind of happiness. It's not the happiness of like holding on to things, but it's the happiness that is open-handed, letting things come and go. It brings a richness to our life, a richness to experience, a fullness to our experience. This kind of happiness, I mean, sometimes I think, I used to believe when I first started this practice, I was exploring the metta practice, which is a practice of well-wishing for other people, wishing for other people's happiness. And as I explored that practice, I found myself really constricted. And part of that constriction was that I believed that happiness was a zero-sum game. That meant if somebody else was happy, there was less of it for me. And I think that this usual view of happiness, where happiness has to do with having things, acquiring things, may contribute to that idea that there is only so much material things to go around. That if I have a certain job, somebody else can't have that job. But the happiness of the open-handed kind of happiness, the happiness that's not about holding on, the happiness that's about allowing, meeting the flow of experience in life, is happiness that doesn't come at anyone else's expense. And we see that happiness, this kind of, a deeper kind of happiness, is not a zero-sum game. In fact, this kind of happiness multiplies itself. the Buddha really did acknowledge that there is happiness of having things. He, at one point in talking to householders, people who lived in the world just like we do, have jobs, he said, there's the happiness of possession, where one possesses wealth acquired, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of one's brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. So there is a happiness to earning a livelihood in a wholesome way. This is essentially what the Buddha is saying here. The happiness of possession is the happiness of earning those possessions in a wholesome way, not in a harmful way, not in a way that causes harm to others. And he says, there's the happiness of enjoyment, which is the happiness of enjoying that wealth that has been acquired without causing harm to others. And included in that form of happiness and of enjoyment is using your possessions to support your families, your friends, to support things that are meaningful to you. So this brings in the quality of the happiness of generosity. This is a practice, at least for me, it has been a practice to explore what is the happiness of generosity. Sometimes, you know, we give and we think we're giving because we think we're supposed to give or because it's good to give. I mean, I still work with this. You know, the people call me on the phone, the telemarketers, you know, but the people for charities call me on the phone. And I often, when I hear them, there's a little bit of a clench, you know. It's like, oh, more people asking for money, you know. So there's a little bit of a clench there. If we can connect to the what that offering is about, as opposed to, oh, I'm supposed to do this because somebody's asking for it. I'm supposed to do this because my parents told me it was a good thing to do. So many different reasons why we would give. But if we can connect to the beauty of giving, the Buddha said that giving adorns the mind. He says it's a beautiful quality of the mind. And it also really helps us to both to let go. It supports the practice of not having that grasping attitude about things. And it also creates connection. So all of these things. You know, the way that we do giving in this culture is not, it's not the most intimate way. In the time of the Buddha, the giving was mostly hand-to-hand. So it really established a connection between the person who was giving and the person who was receiving. And that kind of connection forms relationship, forms community. I had a kind of a demonstration of the happiness of giving at one retreat. Somebody offered me something. It was a 3-month retreat that I was attending. I was sitting the retreat. And my friends here in California sent me a care package. And I received it, I don't know how long it had been sitting in the office, but I received it like the last 3 days of the retreat, like 3 days before the retreat ended. I noticed there was a package there for me. So I opened it up, and it contained 2 huge bags of barbecue potato chips and a pound of See's chocolate, both of things which I love. And I made myself a cup of coffee, and I took one piece of chocolate and I sat there and I put the rest of the chocolates on the table and sat in the dining room. I let it be anonymous, so this isn't quite the same thing as as, you know, giving people one-to-one, you know. But there's a teaching that the Buddha says about generosity, that generosity makes you happy before you give, while you're giving, and after you have given. And I was exploring a little bit of that, because when I got this chocolate and I thought, oh, I can give it away, it made me happy. It made me happy to think about offering it to people who had been meditating. So there was that happiness before. Then there was this huge happiness while I put the chocolate out there and I watched people. I sat there and I watched people. You know, they walked up to, they like their eyes lit up, you know, it's like seized chocolate. And you know, each person selected their chocolate and I watched them eat it and watched the expression on their faces while they were eating it. It was great. I had so much fun watching this. And then, and now, like now, it's like, what, it was like 8 years ago that this happened. And I'm experiencing the happiness now while I'm telling you this story. So the practice of generosity, partly, if you're not feeling a happiness while you're being generous, explore what's going on. What's happening if there's a feeling of contraction when you're offering something? Because there is the possibility that generosity can be a great source of happiness. In Burma, they really value generosity. It's trained into very small children. I spent quite a bit of time in Burma. I was participating in managing a retreat that happened there each January. And we got to know some of the families in the community. And there was one woman who had two little girls, one who was about, oh, 5 or 6, and the other was about 2. And the mother and her sister were over, and we were playing with the kids, and the aunt had, we had given them some candies. We had given the two adults some candies. And the aunt gave one of the candies to the two-year-old and then held out her hand with the gesture of, will you give it back? And the little girl, like, she tried, you know. She tried a couple of times to put it in her aunt's hand. And she couldn't do it. You know, she kept it. But there was no pressure. You know, there wasn't any recrimination, anything. There was a smile, and it's just like it's explored as a practice from the time that they're very young. And so there's a happiness of generosity. And I think this happiness comes when our hearts are not constricted around giving. If there's fear around giving, then the Buddha actually said we should take care when we're giving that it does not adversely affect others or ourselves to give. And this is an interesting reflection on giving. Because sometimes when we give something, a manner of giving can be degrading to somebody. And that may actually cause harm. We may give beyond our means, which could cause harm to us. And so we need to look at our intention, what's behind the reason to give. And when we can connect with this open heart, I think that's when the happiness of generosity is felt, when it's actually felt. Going beyond the happiness of generosity is the happiness, what is called the happiness of blamelessness. And this is the blamelessness. This is the happiness that comes with engaging in ethical conduct. this is the happiness of non-harming. When we act in ways that are connected and conscious of how our, you know, how in our relationships we impact each other. The whole question of ethics in Buddhist practice has to do with non-harming. It's not so much a question of good or bad so much as it is, you know, do you want to have happy relationships? Do you want to have communities that feel safe? Engage in ethical conduct. And happiness arises with that partly through the recognition that we are not creating harm for others or for ourselves. If you think about it, you know, think about if something has happened where you've caused harm for somebody, you know, it doesn't feel good. Usually we have remorse, we have regret. And the bliss of blamelessness is basically comes because we don't have anything to regret. What kind of a life would that be? There was a story of Oprah Winfrey interviewing the Dalai Lama at one point. And she asked him at one point in the interview if he had anything in his life that he regretted. And he said, I think he said something along the lines of, my relationship with mosquitoes is not very good. I have anger towards the mosquitoes. And Oprah was kind of stunned at this, and she said, that's it? Your relationship to mosquitoes is what you have to regret in your life? And she apparently kind of looked out the window for a while, like imagining, you know, what would it be like? What would it be like to have that be your only regret? So the happiness of generosity, the happiness of non-harming, and these things, the happiness of non-harming in particular, is said to be the foundation for the whole depth of our realization of freedom from suffering is grounded in. I'll read a section here from a sutta. For one who is endowed with virtue, there's no need for an act of will. May non-remorse arise in me. It is a natural law that non-remorse will arise in one who is virtuous. For one free of remorse, there is no need for an act of will. May gladness arise in me. It is a natural law that gladness will arise in one who is free from remorse. If you are cognizant of it, I think this is the key. I mean, I've seen at times that, you know, the way we engage in things, it's like if we take on virtuous conduct as a duty, that feeling of heaviness around the duty may obscure the feeling of non-remorse. And so the open-hearted giving of virtue, the open-hearted giving of harmlessness, freely handed harmlessness, will lead one to this quality of non-remorse, will lead one to this quality of gladness. And it goes on, and I won't read the whole thing, but It goes on in this pattern. For one who is glad at heart, there's no need for an act of will. May joy arise. For one who is joyful, there's no need for an act of will. May my body be serene. It's a natural law that the body will be serene. For one of serene body, there's no need for an act of will. May I feel happiness. It's a natural law. For one who is happy, there is no need for an act of will. May my mind be concentrated. It is a natural law for one who is happy that the mind will be concentrated. From concentration, one sees things as they are. One sees things as they are, experiences freedom. Shortening it a little bit. And so there is this kind of grounding in non-harming conduct that leads one through gladness, joy, serenity, happiness, all different forms of happiness, deeper and deeper levels of happiness. But before I talk a little bit about the happiness of concentration, which is where the happiness of letting go, the happiness of not holding on, the happiness of non-harming leads us to a different kind of happiness, a deeper kind of happiness than simply having what we want. And it's a kind of happiness that doesn't cost anything in the world. It costs us our wanting. That's what it costs us. It costs us our wanting. But before I talk about the happiness of concentration, I want to talk a little bit about the happiness of love. I talked about love a few weeks ago and how it's just interwoven in the whole path of our practice. The quality of love comes as the heart is non-constricted. The heart that wants is a heart that's closed, is a heart that is constricted. It's already trying to scheme and negotiate and figure out how to get things and get rid of things. And so that heart is not open, able to receive and give freely. The heart that's able to receive and give freely naturally experiences love. Not the kind of Hallmark greeting card love, but the kind of love that is the love of well-being, the simple love of wishing well for oneself and others. And that open heart, when it meets someone who is successful and happy in their lives, that open heart resonates. Sympathetic, empathetic vibration with that happiness and becomes happy. A famous quote by the Dalai Lama. This was a number of years ago that he said this, when there were 6 billion people on the planet. He said, "It's good to take delight in the delight of others because then you increase your chances of happiness 6 billion to 1. And that kind of happiness also doesn't cost anything. That's the kind of happiness that multiplies. When we can take delight in the delight of others, it's quite lovely because it doesn't drag anyone down. When that open heart, able to give and receive, meets someone who is suffering, the response of that open heart is compassion. And compassion is an interesting kind of feeling. It's in the terrain of happiness. It's a funny kind of happiness. But it's a kind of happiness that is not constricted around pain. It's a kind of emotional connection rather than rejection. It's a connection even in the face of suffering. And that connection itself is a form of, it's a form of happiness. We wouldn't call it what we'd normally call happiness. But it's a form of connection and open-heartedness. This kind of happiness, the happiness of the open heart, is also way more satisfying than having anything. I had an experience around this at one point. We typically, in our love relationships and our relationships with other people, have a kind of, I'll love you if you love me. You know, we have a kind of give and take attitude about those relationships. And it's pretty normal to have that kind of attitude. And there's another deeper kind of connection that I found, you know, just in a very small way, but it was so profound for me to see this. It was a kind of an unrequited love situation where I had a crush on somebody, and it was clear that that person did not reciprocate. And yet it didn't change my feelings. And I struggled with it for a while. I struggled with that feeling. For a couple months, I struggled with that feeling. Somehow I felt like it's not appropriate for me to feel this because the other person doesn't return it. And so I felt like I had to repress the feeling or change the feeling or not have the feeling, that the feelings were wrong or inappropriate or something like that. And at one point, while I was just hanging out with those feelings, I was using mindfulness, practicing with the feelings. I remember I was in my room, and something washed over me that said, "What are you afraid of?" And in that moment, the fear of feeling something, you know, the fear of it being inappropriate fell away, and the heart just opened and connected with that person. And it was such a beautiful feeling of connection. The person was nowhere to be seen. I mean, I was in my room by myself. But it was such a beautiful feeling of connection. And the surprise to me in that moment was the thing that my mind recognized in that moment was it was just like such a, the heart filled with the wish for that person to be happy. It's like, oh, I hope that you're happy. And the heart just filled with that wish. And in that moment, what I felt or recognized was, this is the feeling that I've been looking for in trying to find relationships to have somebody love me back. That feeling of loving without any need to have anything in return, that was the feeling that I had been looking for. And it didn't need reciprocation. That changed my life that moment. Completely changed my life. That simple, it wasn't like I was experiencing vast metta for the entire universe. I just felt this sense of, I wish you're, for one person, I wish that you're happy. And saw, it didn't need anything back. It's way more deeply satisfying, that kind of happiness, than having anything. And it doesn't need anything. It doesn't need anything. I'm going to try to collapse a couple of these. There's so many more kinds of happinesses here. I've got to talk about the happiness of concentration. You'll get to, hopefully some of you will get to explore this with Max in the next 5 weeks. You know, concentration is a state that comes as the mind collects, gathers, and is not so scattered. Unification of mind is one way to term concentration. The mind is not reactive about things that are happening in the world. in ourselves, not reactive to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. It doesn't mean that we're non-responsive. It means that we're not fighting what is. And so this state of the mind being unified, collected in this way, it feels really good. It feels really good for the mind to be gathered like this. In some of my concentration practices and some of the times I've practiced concentration, I've experienced certain states of where it just felt like, the way I described it to myself is it felt like every single cell in my body was pointing in the same direction. It's like every single cell in my body felt happy. It was happiness at a very, very deep level, a visceral, bodily, suffused kind of happiness. So these states of concentration can create a sense of well-being that doesn't rely on having material things, having anybody else's opinion. It's a much deeper kind of happiness, this happiness of concentration. And one of the supports for this kind of concentration is letting go of needing things in the world to be a certain way, to needing to have certain pleasant experiences or unpleasant experiences. That's not to say that we don't get attached to the state of concentration itself. We do. It's such a pleasant experience. Of course we want more of it. And then we see that the very trying to hold on to it, it falls through our fingers. So in a way, the happiness of concentration comes most readily when we let go. And the happiness of concentration is like a deep, deep kind of nourishment. As the mind is concentrated, as it moves into concentration, it starts the next piece in this lawfulness of progress, is the mind that's concentrated sees things as they are. Seeing things as they are is kind of, sometimes the way I like to think about it is it's the coming into alignment with the truth of what's actually going on. Usually our orientation to the world has some deluded beliefs to it. You know, the very act of thinking that happiness comes from getting what we want is delusion. It's got a delusional quality to it because it basically thinks that that's the best kind of happiness there is, that getting what I want is where happiness is found. And as I pointed to earlier, the release from the wanting creates a happiness that we can experience without ever getting the thing that wanting wants. And so we carry delusions around with us. We see things through filters. There's kind of some core filters that we experience life through. We take things that are impermanent to be lasting or permanent. We take things that are unreliable to be reliable sources of happiness. And we take things that are uncontrollable to be controllable. And if we don't actually take things to be permanent, reliable, and controllable, we think they should be permanent, reliable, and controllable. We think it's a mistake or we've done something wrong when things are pointed out that they're impermanent, unreliable, and out of control. Rather than recognizing, oh, this is actually the way it is. There's a deeper kind of happiness, deeper even than the happiness of concentration, that comes when we find ourselves aligned with this truth. That things are unreliable, impermanent, out of control. It sounds paradoxical. How can one be happy with that as the state of things? Well, it is the state of things. And the vast majority of our happiness comes from resisting that is the state of things. The vast majority of our struggle comes from resisting the truth. And so the happiness of concentration basically gives us a kind of a ballast to lean against while we're opening to these truths. We can kind of use the happiness of concentration to rest, to nourish ourselves, while we're starting to meet the truths of impermanent, unreliable, out of control. This is the happiness of meeting these truths, of kind of aligning ourselves with this truth, these truths, is the happiness of insight. And this manifests in different ways for us. You know, just some simple examples. You know, many of you may have experienced like seeing something challenging, like, irritation or frustration. And then using some of the tools of mindfulness and trying to recognize, okay, I've been told it's helpful to just say, to recognize, okay, frustration's happening right now. It's just frustration. Pay attention in the body. See if I can let go of the stories around frustration. And that shift of perspective basically is shifting an orientation towards these three truths. In like irritation, for example, or frustration is born because it basically thinks things should be another way. Thinks things should be permanent or reliable. We find things aren't going my way, and frustration arises. When we can just recognize, frustration is happening right now. We're letting go a little bit around our fighting with the truth and just instead turning towards the experience of frustration in the moment. And what do we see when we turn towards the experience of frustration in the moment? It's impermanent. As we open to just the experience of frustration, we see it changes. If we're not feeding it with thoughts and ideas of, that person shouldn't have done that thing and I need to fix that or change that. If we're just experiencing and recognizing, this is the experience of frustration. This is what it's like. It will pass. And we will experience the release of that state of mind falling apart. Of that struggle falling apart. And so that's a form of insight. It's a form of recognition to be able to turn towards our confusion, our irritation, our annoyance, our fear, our anxiety, our boredom, sounds we don't like, things we don't want to have, things we like we want to hold on to, turning towards the experience and recognizing this is what's happening now. That open-handed quality of not either trying to hold on or push away will help us enter into that happiness of the open heart that doesn't cling or resist, and will help us to meet these truths, impermanent, unreliable, out of control, and not be freaked out about it. actually be able to, it's like endlessly surfing the waves. So everything's, it's almost like we're in quicksand, but we're never sinking completely. When we're not resisting it, it's just like we're, it's just this endless shifting sands. And it doesn't have to be a problem. And yet we do constrict and react. And we can look at that very constriction. Concentration being a great support for us as we open to these truths. I'll finish by reading something the Buddha said. At one point, this is after his enlightenment experience, he said, at one point, having understood the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of sense pleasures, I abandoned craving for sense pleasures. I removed the fever of sense pleasures, and I dealt without thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace. Notice he didn't say I abandoned sense pleasure. I abandoned the craving, the fever, the thirst for sense pleasure. I dwell with a mind inwardly at peace. I see other people who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, being devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, burning with the fever of sensual pleasures, indulging in sensual pleasures, and I do not envy them. Why is that? Because there is a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior. So this is the possibility of our practice, to carry us from this kind of constricted happiness to an open-hearted happiness that just meets life as it is, but is not in that non-reactivity, non-responsive. It's non-reactive. But the very meeting of things as they are, I would say, there's a famous quote, I think it's from Dogen, leads to an appropriate response. So I need to stop now. Thank you for your attention.